The other day, in the local newspaper, there was a cartoon, and I thought it was so apropos that I made a little copy of it and thought I'd share it with you as we get started here. Some of you are familiar with this comic strip called Animal Crackers. I don't know if it's in your newspaper or not, but this is the first part of it. You get the picture there. This is the leader. And then this is his reaction. Now, as I thought about that, I find that in the ministry that the Lord has allowed in these last 8 years since we started this, I find that I get caught in a very interesting bind, because I travel around talking with our staff, with you fellas, and people that you're working with, and I have you share with me very honestly some of your frustrations and some of the things that you're struggling with. And very often that has to do with administrative leadership. That is to say, what's going on at the international office and some of the decision making that takes place there. And the bind, of course, is in sensing the reality of your struggle and the struggle of the other staff members, and knowing that the spirit and the heart, generally speaking, of that person who is expressing that frustration or struggle is honest, desirous of pleasing God. From their perspective, they have a valid point of view, obviously. And yet knowing, as I do, that Jack and Lorne and the men who are involved in seeking to make the decisions that have to do with the direction of the work are men who, by my evaluation and others as well, and yours of course, are seeking to find the will of God for this work. There's no desire to arbitrarily make decisions and arbitrarily protect personal interest. And in my particular position, since I do not fit into the administrative chart of any line responsibility, I find myself in a great area of freedom to express opinions in both directions, because I do not represent, in a very real sense, some of that administrative decision-making involvement. By the same token, I do represent the men who are making those decisions. And what I want to try and share with you today are, among other things, some of the observations that I have made, perhaps some opinions, and where they are opinions, I'll try and identify them very clearly so that you can reject them, accept them, do whatever you want with them. But opinions that I have regarding why some of these tensions exist at times and what we can do to alleviate them, to minimize them. This cartoon speaks to an area of that, which is basically the area of communication. I think if I were to say today what I observe worldwide in our organization is a need for more effective communication. I'm not talking about communications. I'm talking about communication at an interpersonal level. I think that in connection with that, there is a breakdown at times when that communication is lacking, a breakdown in the level of confidence. Now, what I've tried to say at the beginning is that as I get around and hear some of the experiences that the staff is having, some of the questions that they have, some of the struggles that they have, some of the misunderstandings that they have at times regarding what they think are arbitrary decisions by management, to use that term, I think that largely it's based on a lack of communication, effective communication. Which, of course, means that those in every position of leadership have to take the responsibility of seeking to develop to the highest level possible an effective mode, whatever mode would be fitting, of communicating both upwards and downwards. And we'll use those phrases. I don't particularly like the hierarchy and the structure that exists, but it's a necessity because we know that in the body of Christ there is no superiority or inferiority, but God sees fit to select some for positions of one kind and another. But that management module or molecule, whichever you want to call it, that Jack demonstrated for us would work as a good illustration of what I'm trying to say in the area of communication. And this morning, one of the things I want to talk about, and we'll get to it in just a minute, is how we go about trying to do that more effectively with our staff. Because I say again, I really feel that probably is one of the areas in which we need, at this point in our history, and some of you are doing it, I'm not implying that it's not being done at all, but we need all of us to improve the means and the level of interpersonal communication with our staff. And that's one of the things I want to stress during these hours with you, and to which I would like to have you reply. The second thing that I think I want to try and communicate to some degree is that I believe that one of the things that attracted me to the Navigators back in 1952, when I first met Doss and interacted with him, and then later came to the 53 seminar that was held down at Star Ranch, and from that point on, was the emphasis in personal holiness. Now, in that concept, in that word, holiness, there's a lot of negative connotations because of some movements, because of the charismatic movement at times, because of some of the Pentecostal holiness groups or the Arminian theological point of view. But it's a very good word. The Word of God tells us that we're to be holy as God is holy. And personal holiness is something for which we must be striving continually. And I suppose a concern, personal, is that in my own life, I can become so expert in counseling, I can attend seminars and read books as I'm trying to do, and be able to sit down and effectively counsel and develop a reputation as quite a good counselor, and go on the basis of that reputation for many years without the lack of holiness beginning to show through. Now, what can happen to an individual can happen to an organization. We've seen that in history. We could name religious organizations today that at one time were the epitome of godliness and holiness and God consciousness and concern for their own walk with God and the burning passion for Jesus. And today are functioning as religious organizations. They're still functioning. And they still have lots of people coming to their situations. But the Shekinah glory that the scriptures talk about is not there. The presence of God is not there. Now, I'm sure that all of you have thought of this. This is not a new thought. But that can happen to any organization, and the navigators are not exempt. We have not been inoculated against spiritual failure. And that has to start right where you are. That doesn't start at an organizational level. No decree coming down from the top is going to change that. No decision that's made in the cloistered halls of meetings is going to change that. That's going to happen right where you are, or it's not going to happen at all. The warmth. What it talks about in Malachi, where when they got together, they just talked about God. In the, some of you are familiar with this, just to remind you, in the area of levels of communication, these have been suggested. Some of you know them, you've read them, you've seen them. I want to make a comment very briefly. I don't want to get involved in discussing all of these. You can recognize them all. But I want to tell you where I see the greatest pitfalls in these levels of communication. I see it here and here, in 2 and 3, for this reason. We can get together and we can talk about Joe and his needs and what we need to do to help Joe. And we can come up with guidelines and we can talk about scriptural principles. And we can leave. You and I could sit down and spend an hour and a half, 2 hours doing that. And we could separate and we could think we've communicated. And in a sense, we have. But we haven't communicated at the level that I feel it's imperative that we communicate. And I'll demonstrate why in just a moment from the scriptures. It's imperative that we communicate if we are to maintain the sharp cutting edge of our own spiritual walk with God. We can talk about many things that are important and never really have communicated where we are personally. The third one is just as dangerous because I see that happening in Bible study group after Bible study group. I've sat in on a number. I've done it myself. In fact, I have as much of a tendency to do it today as I ever have. And I guard against this when Jim and I get together in our weekly times. In fact, we try to get together more than weekly. We try to get together a couple of times a week and sometimes more than that. But I find that if we're not careful, we can spend an hour and a half and discuss situations and discuss ideas and judgments, even spiritual ideas, doctrinal ideas, biblical ideas, and never have revealed anything about ourselves. So what I'm suggesting is in the area of communication, this thing we're talking about, there has to be a willingness to go beyond those levels, and I hope to at least stimulate your thinking as to why we may not do that. Communication, confidence, holiness. Personal holiness. All right, with that in mind, I'd like to try and set the stage here with a few thoughts. In Acts 20, you're familiar with that passage where Paul calls the elders. In verse 17, he calls the elders from Ephesus to give them a final word as he's leaving. I was interested in this because in reading 1 Timothy in preparation for this, I noticed that in the NASB and other, the NIV and some of the other newer translations, 1 Timothy 3 speaks to the issue of overseers. It uses that word, as you'll remember. If a man aspires to the office of overseer, and of course the word there is the word that we also use for bishop. And in this passage in Acts 20, it's interesting that in the original language, two different words are used to describe the same group of people. There in verse 17, the word that is used is translated elder. And it's the word from which we get the concept of the Presbyterian form of government. The word presbyteros. Then in verse 20, the same group of men is referred to as overseers. And the word there is the word that's being used or has been used as the basis for the Episcopalian group, episkopos. So here, God very graciously puts the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians together, and he says, you're all the same thing. The point I'm making, and what I want to communicate, is that everywhere you read in the New Testament the word elder, I recommend to you that you realize those are instructions for you. You are an elder. In the biblical sense of the word, you have been given the responsibility for the spiritual oversight of some people. That's what the word means. The elder, the bishop concept, all the same. There's no differentiation. In fact, in reading Vine, he points that out. That there is no distinction made in the New Testament between those two offices. The words are used interchangeably. They all mean the same thing, overseer. And so I want to talk with us during these hours about a leader as an overseer. An overseer. And what that might mean. Particularly in the context of our experience and our ministry together. In 1 Peter 5, 1 through 3, Peter gives us some of the guidelines, some of the responsibilities of an overseer. He calls it the elder. We're going to forget the word that's used. Remember, they're used interchangeably. I am going to utilize the word overseer in every situation. I exhort the overseers among you, and here you are, right in this room. You are, in very fact, gentlemen, you are the men that God, in His own choices, for His own reasons, that God has placed in the position of spiritual overseers. Lawrence Sanney, Jack Mayhall, George Sanchez, and all of the rest of us here are in this same category. These instructions are for all of us who have spiritual responsibility for part of the flock of God. And Peter says, in the introduction, he identifies who he is, and then he says in verse 2, shepherd the flock. Shepherd the flock of God among you. Not under compulsion, but voluntarily. I don't want to take a lot of time on that second phrase. I simply would like to say this. Sometimes I have heard among our staff, particularly among some of the men who have responsibility, man, I don't have time to spend with those people. We've got to keep this thing moving. We've got objectives to meet and we've got goals to take care of. That's what he is trying to imply. Not under compulsion, not because I feel I have to do that, so yeah, I'll go get time with so-and-so. That isn't going to do a bit of good. That isn't shepherding. But an attitude that reaches out for the heart and the need of people. Voluntarily. Voluntarily, because God has said it, according to the will of God. See, for an overseer, it is the will of God that he shepherd. Not a matter of choice. This is a spiritual warfare in which we find ourselves. And I could tell you story after story of situations that come up among our staff of spiritual battles that are not going to be won by directives. They're not going to be won by new goals. They're not going to be won by new strategies. They're going to be won when somebody comes alongside that person and demonstrates love and cares and sits down and prays with them and helps them through. I'm convinced of that. And of course, I'm going to emphasize it today. And you realize that I am not in any way minimizing what has been shared regarding the needs for some of the expertise in the other areas of management. Shepherd. Other words that are used are tend or feed. All of these are interchangeable words in various paraphrases and translations. Tend or feed the flock that is among you. And I was interested because that verse that Jack used at the beginning of his time with us yesterday from Psalm 78, what a beautiful verse that is. But did you notice it uses the very same terminology? 78, verse 72, the last verse of the chapter. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart. He fed them, he tended them, whatever it means. Proverbs 27, 23. I think is a key passage for us. It says, know well the condition of your flock. Now, if you have an NASB, you'll notice that in the margin it says that word condition means the face. The face of your flock. In the context of that verse, he's talking about a shepherd, about a man who raises sheep for profit. And he goes on to say, if you take care of them, the profits will take care of you later on. Now there's a spiritual analogy there. But the point that I'm making is that in order to tend the flock, in order to care for the flock, in order to feed the flock, we must know their face. And that means person-to-person contact. And that means person-to-person attention. One year, I don't remember when it was, in this room, some of you probably were here. In fact, I'm certain you were. We had a meeting, I think it was of all the... it was similar to this kind of a meeting, but I don't know what we called it in those days. And we asked everybody to come with a 500-word paper on what you thought was the greatest strength and also the greatest weakness in the navigators. Some of you remember that. And then we compiled that and all of us were given a copy of all the papers that were sent in. I remember at that time I shared what I felt and what I still feel. One of the things that we, the navigators, hold so high is the whole concept of spiritual reproduction. The one-on-one concept. And I said at that time, and I would like to repeat to you today, that it is possible, that's one of the strengths of the navigators, but it is possible to spend personal time with someone and not meet individual needs. You can spend personal time and communicate at level 2 or level 3 that we looked at a moment ago. Talk about ministry. Talk about plans, talk about strategy, talk about conference, talk about the staff, and never really find out where that person is in their own area of need. We had a situation where a man fell into a moral sin, a sexual moral sin. That's not unusual. Happens all the time, unfortunately, in the world and among Christians as well. We're hoping, of course, that it doesn't happen too frequently among us. But it does, and it did. And as we sought to put that whole thing back together again, both the marriage as well as the personal struggle that that individual was going through, I asked the question. I said, now, when that started, back at the beginning, not when you got involved, but when the first thoughts began to come into your mind and the temptation began to trouble you and you allowed it to stay. Because I've learned, as you have, fellas, that nobody precipitously falls into that kind of a sin. It's a process. The scripture says, keep your heart with all vigilance, for out of it are the issues of life. What we think produces what we are. So, the thinking process at some point allows that to begin, then opportunity presents itself, then it takes place. But you realize that that's been going on for a while. So I asked him about this process. He says, oh yeah, I knew when I was struggling. I said, wasn't there anybody there that you could talk to? I said, the man that you were responsible to spiritually? I said, why didn't you go to him and say, look, I'm struggling, I need some help. He said, because I knew if I went, I had done it once before on another issue, and I knew if I went, I would get chopped off at the knees and be judged, and I would be held totally accountable and not receive any kind of help. That can happen. It did happen. We who are biblical, my friends, can become very rigid. You and I can become very rigid. Because the Bible speaks in absolutes. And we can deal in absolutes. In fact, we can deal in absolutes so much that we overlook the humanity with which we're also dealing. The struggles of that individual. The needs that that person has. That's what it means to know the face of your flock. What's really going on? Well, in Acts 20:28, it says, be on guard for your flock. Be on guard for your flock. Watch over them. I'm not going to try and tell you what that span should be. That isn't for me to determine, and it isn't for someone else to determine. This is why I said yesterday that a great deal of that depends on the capacity of the individual. But I am going to say that there is a need for us to make this a more major part of our involvement with our staff and with one another. With one another. Be on guard. Because it goes on to say, if you'll notice in that same verse, be on guard for yourselves. In Hebrews, the 3rd chapter, there's a passage with which we're all so familiar, and yet to me it has just come in a new sense of importance. Hebrews 3:12-13. Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart, which causes you to fall away from the living God. Can that happen to us? Of course it can happen to us. I think whenever we allow ourselves to begin to complain, hear me well, whenever we allow ourselves to begin to complain and to blame, they didn't take me into consideration when they made that decision. Or whatever the nature of our complaint might be. we are beginning to allow the evil consequences of an unbelieving heart. You say, wait a minute. What about the personal prerogatives? What about the will of God for my life? Where does that come in? Am I just a puppet on a chessboard and somebody says jump and I jump? No. But in a moment, we're going to look at the story of a man who did just that, and he had every reason not to do it. A biblical story. Because of two things. He was convinced that God was in control of his life and that God was in control of the man who asked him to do what he did. There are times, gentlemen, when we must say, that is not what I would choose to do. If I had my personal preference, that is not what I would choose to do. But my friends, the will of God is not always what I would choose to do. And when we begin to allow ourselves to think that when somebody asks us to do something that we don't particularly want to do, that therefore they're not taking us into consideration, that becomes very self-indulgent and self-centered. And we must be very careful. And I would be glad to explain that further with questions that might come up. Beware of your own heart. We are not immune to the consequences of an evil, unbelieving heart. You and I are not immune to that. I'll have more to say about that in just a moment. Now, it goes on to say the way in which we can avoid some of this. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it is called today, lest any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. The deceitfulness of sin. It is remarkable to me to see how sin can deceive. I had a lady come, and she said, I'm ready to leave my husband and our two children. I've had it. I said, well, then what do you want to talk to me about? If you've already made up your mind, what do you want me to do? Put my seal of approval on it or what? She was honest enough to say, no, I think I really want to know if there's something that can be done. I said, okay. We talked. Now I said, is he willing to come? Yes, he is. He knows I came, and he said he'd be willing to come. Fine. So we got together, and we've been working on it. The other day, we've now gone through a number of times together. She came. They had an appointment, and she came. But he was unable to come because of a contradiction in his schedule that he hadn't been aware of. So we took advantage of the time. And she sat there and she said, you know, it's a little embarrassing for me to have to admit this. But she said, I came because I thought the fault was all his. And then I sent my daughter to you because I thought it was her fault. And what I have seen as we've gone along is that it really has been my fault all the time. And it's true. But she was completely deceived. The deceitfulness of sin. And gentlemen, the deceitfulness of sin that allows us to complain and that allows us to criticize. Oh, I'm not talking about expressing honest opinions. I mean that spirit of destructive criticism. And you know the difference. That can destroy us. It will lead us to resentment and to bitterness. We'll see a little bit more about that in just a bit. Encourage one another. Now, one of the things we need, we talked about the management molecule to go up and down in our radiating of communication. If this is to be true, if we are to be encouraged by our brethren, whether it is our superior or a subordinate on the chain of command, there must be an attitude of approachability on our part. Where subordinates feel free to come and talk with us. Not just our superiors and not just our peers, but where we communicate an honest openness, a desire to grow, to allow God to speak to us, to change our lives, to open our hearts to criticism, to whatever we need. This is what the Word of God means when it talks about a teachable spirit. A teachable spirit has no limits. I'll learn from thus and so, or from so and so, or if they're in a higher spot in the chain of command, or a peer, and so on. No. The teachable concept in the Scripture is that whoever I am is immaterial. If I want to grow biblically, if I want to grow in holiness, my life must be open to allow God to use whoever He wants to bring to my attention whatever He wants. That's the only way that ministry of encouragement can take place. I can't go into your life and try to encourage you unless you invite me. I may try and get turned off. And you've had that happen to you, and I've had that happen to me. Or you see a brother in need and you move in and you try to make a suggestion and you get a closed door. And at that point you can do no more. There is nothing more you can do until the Spirit of God touches that life. And I'm afraid that at times some of us do that. Beware of your own heart. Be open to communication. Be vulnerable to allow God to use whoever He wants. Ecclesiastes 4:13, I think, states one of the most tragic things that I can think of. You're all familiar with the phrase, "A poor yet wise lad is better than an old, foolish navigator leader who no longer knows how to receive instruction." I think that is the tragedy of tragedies. A man who comes to the place where he no longer is willing or knows how to receive instruction. Let me tell you why. You know it, but let's just review it. In Obadiah, verse 3, this was pointed out to me just this morning. If I can just find Obadiah again. It talks about the matter of pride. I'm back here, fellas. Here it is. Obadiah 3. It's just one page long, and that's, I keep going by it in every direction. Follows Amos. The arrogance or the pride of your heart has deceived you. Oh, I pray God that we won't let that happen. As men, as individuals, as an organization, we can become arrogant as an organization. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. That just goes along with Jeremiah 17:9, remember? Heart is deceitful. And put that together with Revelation 12:9, where it says that the devil is the deceiver. So you put my deceitfulness and the devil's deceitfulness, and he's a master at it, you put those two together and I can be a victim of deceit. The deceitfulness of sin. How can I avoid some of that? Well, obviously my attitude before God, to really communicate my heart to God and keep it open before Him, but to keep my heart open to my brethren and say, "Look, I need you. and let that communication come as God desires. That's one of the reasons, the pride factor. Another reason that keeps us from opening our lives is the desire to maintain control. Let me put it another way. The concept that I'm the spiritual leader, and we don't say the rest, but the communication is, so what do you have to say to me? We can fall into that trap, the desire to maintain control. And then another delusion, and I hope you're not caught in this, that you have to have all the answers. We've already spoken to that. Jack referred to it. One of the most refreshing things that can happen is for a person to say, I don't really know, but I'd like to learn. Maybe we can learn that together. But to try and fake your way through. You see, that causes, in terms that we think of in counseling, that causes a threatened posture. And a threatened posture always creates defensiveness. Whenever someone is threatened, they respond defensively. I don't have all the answers. I have had on more than one occasion, gentlemen, discussions with younger staff at the contact level, or even previous to being in contact staff, who have told me, this is not just in America, but overseas as well, that whenever they have gone to their leader with some questions, they have gotten the answer that they have no right to answer, to ask those questions. They have been accused of not being submissive. They have been accused of not being loyal because they have questions that they want to ask. Questions that threaten the leader. Maybe they even have better ideas about how something might work, but the leader isn't willing to admit it. See, that's part of this arrogance of pride that makes us the old and foolish navigators that will no longer be instructed. Now, I'd like for you to do something with me. We're going to just very quickly look at this story I mentioned in the scripture. It's in the book of Genesis. It's chapter 24. And it's the entire chapter, and we're not going to read it. You're all familiar with the story, but I want to pick out some characteristics because I see here a representative of all of us in this room. Here was a man who was an overseer. But he also is a beautiful illustration of the servant leader. And an overseer must be, first of all, a servant. A servant leader. Now in this story, the first thing we see is in verse 2 that he had charge of all his household and all that he owned. He had a place of tremendous responsibility. He was next, if you please, to Abraham. Age was in his favor, that is to say, seniority, authority, responsibility, whatever denominational terms you want to use at that point, he had it all. And God, and Abraham said to him, here's what I need for you to do. His response was immediate. He didn't try to decide, well, is this what God wants me to do? He had already made that decision. I am Abraham's servant. That decision had been made. He didn't have to go through that again. He didn't say, well, now, wait a minute. There are a lot of younger men that could do this. That's a tough trip you're asking me to take. Those camels, they don't do my stomach much good these days. That rocking back and forth, I just get a little old for that. Well, my situation at home right now, I need to make sure that gets the right attention. Let me make a parenthetical statement here. And it very likely is to be misunderstood. If anything I say this morning is going to be misunderstood, maybe this will. Years ago, about 1967, we began the emphasis on the family. Lorne asked that we do something along this line, and so we began up in Denver. In fact, we started in Greeley when we were still working on the campus up there. We had a summer thing with some couples, out of which grew the Scriptural Home Seminar. I remember when we started the emphasis to the staff regarding the family responsibilities that the man had and the priorities and so forth. Several men in places of responsibility in the Navigators at that time came to me and they expressed a negative reaction to what I was sharing. And the expression was this: if the people get too involved in their families, man, we're going to lose the cutting edge of our ministry. I couldn't agree with it, and before the Lord, did not feel I could capitulate, and so I continued. Through the years, God has increased the ministry among us and from us to many others regarding the importance of the family, relationships, priorities, and all the rest of it. And I'm delighted because I think it is biblically sound. But, as in every case, there is a tendency to allow the pendulum to swing too far. And I think that I see signs of that as a possibility, where decisions are too often weighed on the basis of what is best for the family. There are times when that has to be taken into consideration. Don't misunderstand me. I'm throwing out a word of caution that we be careful not to let that get out of balance in our thinking, that it be overemphasized. The family is important, but let me just give you a very encouraging word about moving the family. First of all, from our experience, we moved our family at every age you can imagine, into every grade of school you can imagine. If we were to ask, I wish I could have all three of them here who are now 27, 28, and 30. I think that all of them would say to you what they've said to us, that there was never any negative experience in all of that. The reason being that we worked at maintaining the unity of that family. And so wherever we went, we moved as a body, as a unity. And the geographical implications didn't really shake that up too much. A study was made recently, both for the military as well as one of the major corporations in America that sends people all over the world. And they came up with much the same by way of some of their findings. Now, I don't want to go off on that, and I'm not trying to in any way make a point of anybody or any situation. I'm talking about a principle and a tendency that I see that we must be careful that we don't let get out of perspective. Well, here's this man. Probably could have thought of various reasons why he shouldn't do that. But his response was, no, I'll go. I'll go. Now, I see several qualities in this man's life. I want to throw them out to you very quickly. First, I see the quality of humility. We won't talk about that to any degree. We've all studied that, read about it, are familiar with it. I would like to suggest to you that I understand biblical humility to be the expression of Romans 12:3, having an honest estimate, a sane estimate of oneself. That is what I believe to be biblical humility. not putting myself down, not thinking that somebody else is better than I am. I think there's a misunderstanding about that passage in Philippians 2, 3, and 4. I'm saying that I believe that when God speaks of humility, He is simply saying, look, look at yourself, see who you are, recognize what God has given you, don't try to be more than you are, and don't consider yourself any less than you are. Spiritual humility, a sane, healthy estimate. My abilities and my limitations, both. I think that's why in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, when Jesus was talking, He said, when you learn that, you'll find rest for your soul. See, the person that arrives at that is no longer competing, no longer comparing themselves with somebody else. But you talk about something that will bring peace. That does. A.W. Tozer, who is one of my favorite writers, he writes this. Someone wrote the godly Macarius of Optino, whoever that was, that his spiritual counsel had been helpful. Macarius wrote back, this cannot be. Only the mistakes are mine. All good advice is the advice of the Spirit of God, His advice that I happen to have heard rightly and to have passed on without distorting it. But remember, only the mistakes are mine. There's a real attitude of humility. I don't have that kind of counsel to give. I don't have that kind of wisdom to spread out. Whatever counsel, whatever wisdom there is, comes from God. James tells us that. We must be careful not to take to ourselves accomplishments that are not ours. Tozer goes on to say, we often pray, any of us, Lord, you know I'm nothing. But let someone else agree with that statement, and we get upset. So we see in this man humility. The second thing we see is in verses 3 through 7, and that is the matter of vision. That's the best word I could find. I don't know that it's the best word. But what it says is that he had clear instructions and he knew what his task was. He knew what he was trying to accomplish. He was to get a bride. He was not to settle for alternatives. And verse 7, he had confidence in God to accomplish that goal. So here he starts out. He's got his goal. He knows what he's to do. And he believes that God is involved with him. A servant leader. Third, verses 12 through 14. I'd like to take a minute on this one. Verses 12 through 14. And he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. I want you to note all through here, gentlemen, nowhere is his name given to us. We know what his name is from another passage of Scripture. His name was Eliezer. But it's not here. Through this entire passage, his whole communication with God is for the sake of his master Abraham. A servant leader. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. By this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to me. No, to my master. The knowledge of God, that's the quality in his life here. And earlier when I talked about this concept of holiness or godliness, whatever word we want to use, this is what I mean. A knowledge of God. And I'm not talking about a theoretical, hypothetical, theological, doctrinal, intellectual knowledge of God. I'm talking about the knowledge of God that grips our souls and causes us to be aware and sensitive before God in every area of our life, in the way we deal with people, in the way we make decisions, in the way we react to the decisions that others have made that God has placed in positions of authority and responsibility. Our attitude, gentlemen, is controlled by our knowledge of God. Remember we said, keep your heart with all vigilance. The thinking process produces my attitudes. What I think produces how I respond. And if my thinking regarding God is shoddy, limited, careless, maybe overgrown with weeds of lack of tending, then my attitude response is going to be that way. A.W. Tozer says in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, the most important thing about any person is what comes to their mind when they think about God. And that's what I think he was trying to say. My concept of God. And by the way, fellas, I find this probably one of the most continually needy areas as I deal with our staff. It's interesting. The problem may be this. Whatever this is. Out here is the issue that they come to talk about. And I listen and try to understand and respond and interact with them. But if we are able to effectively move to the cause for that situation and come back to what is really the cause, very, very often we find that it's their concept of God. Hebrews 11:6, man, such a simple little verse, but what a fantastic principle. God is who he claims to be, and he will do what he promised to do. Now, this is one of the needs that we face with our staff. But you see, if I am not in touch with the reality of that statement, if I am not convinced that God is who he claims to be, that he is a God of control. I learned a passage recently that's just been a blessing to me. It's Job 23:8-14. And the last two verses of that passage say this, but he is unique. Now remember who's saying it and where he is. He's sitting there in the middle of that floor scratching his body with shells and having all of these supposed friends peppering him from all sides. And at the beginning he says, behold, I go forward, he's not there. I go backward, I cannot behold him. He acts on the left, I do not see him. He turns on the right, I don't know he's there. In his emotions, he couldn't find God anywhere. But the next verse says, but he knows the way I take. See, he knew. But he goes on in that verse that I want to quote, verse 13. It says this, but he is unique, and who can turn him? And what his soul desires, that he does. Now, fellas, do I really believe that? Or do I say, no, in this situation it's different. The navigators are fouling it up. They are making the wrong decisions. Okay, maybe they are. Boy, I know that. We all make wrong decisions. But is God capable of taking that whole thing and sifting it out and bringing about what is pleasing in his sight? Is he who Job says he is, unique? And what his soul desires, he will do. But then he goes further. He says, and he performs what is appointed for me. And many such decrees are with him. Now, if I'm not convinced of that, I'm not going to be able to shepherd my flock. I'm not going to be able to tend my flock. I'm not going to be able to feed my flock. Because that is the most important part of tending and feeding. the knowledge of God. I read in a book recently, some of you may remember I mentioned it in one of our seminars on counseling, I think. It's a book by Rollo May, who is a current psychologist. And he talks in there about what he calls the Messiah complex, which simply means the idea that I am indispensable somehow. I'm indispensable. See, there is a balance here between knowing the face or the condition of my flock and feeding them and trying to encourage them, and knowing that I do not want to make them feel dependent on me in any way. That is not what is involved in trying to feed and tend. In fact, what we're trying to do is help them grow to a period, a point of independence from us as fast as we can. And there's the balance between those two. Well, let's go on to the next quality in this man's life so we can wind it up. The fourth one is, or the third one, whatever it is, fourth, self-control. Self-control. Verse 21 says he didn't speak. He gazed at her in silence to know whether this was the will of God. He didn't speak. Self-control. Proverbs 25:28, a man without self-control is like a city that is broken into and without walls. I'd like to read James 3:2 out of the Living, if I may, because I think it says it so much more clearly. We're familiar with it. James 3:2. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. The control of the tongue, gentlemen, is a very real evidence of maturity. The lack of control of our tongue is just the opposite. And I would like to suggest to us that in a fellowship like ours, it is so easy to demonstrate a lack of control of the tongue. I find that information gets passed on as factual, which in fact is nothing more than rumor. And the reason, to go back to what we said originally, is a lack of communication. The thing to do when you hear something that you're not certain of is to find out from the person from which you feel it originated to find out if it's true. We said that in the molecule or the module, whichever you want to call it, the leader must be open both ways. Then you should call whoever it might be, if it's Jack or if it's Lorne or whatever. There should be that kind of openness and communication among us. If we are going to be a biblical fellowship, that must exist. And I think I can speak for them, though Jack isn't here right now, but I think I can speak for them that they are open to receiving that kind of communication. But the control of the tongue. Proverbs 10:19 and 12:18 talk about some of the disastrous effects when this is not true. Proverbs 10:19. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. Now, yesterday Jack said something, and I want to speak to it, not because I think Jack was remiss in what he said, but just because I think there needs to be a word of caution exercised. He talked about discussing your personnel with one another and the needs that various ones might have. I think there is a validity in that, and there is a way in which that can be done legitimately. But it is very, very easy for it to slip into illegitimate exposure of information that's not necessary. And you know, and I know, because you've been there, and I've talked with the staff enough to know, that one of the areas in which our staff probably feels as insecure as anything is, what's going to happen if I do say something to somebody? Who's that going to be shared with? How broadly will it be discussed? It's a very real fear. It's a very normal reaction. So I think that even there must be some discretion regarding how much is said. Then the next thing is in verses 26 and 27, and there was a modesty. A modesty about this man. He was not boastful. He didn't take any personal credit. He recognized that what had happened, God had done. And there was a delightful, honest, fragrant modesty about his expression in those two verses. The man bowed low and worshiped the Lord, and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master." You see, he's still not taking any of that to himself. "To my master, as for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brother," and so on. Modesty. We live in an accomplishment-oriented society, a task-oriented society. We need to be very careful about what kind of accomplishments we take credit for. The next thing is in verse 33, and it was selflessness. He put duty above his personal welfare. He didn't want to eat until this thing had been done. He said, "No, I want to finish this project up." Let me give a word of caution here. Here's that syndrome that we're going to talk about later today. This over-conscientiousness that we all experience and that our staff experiences that causes us to drive ourselves beyond what we should at times. That's not what he's saying. Because notice, please, just put down as a cross-reference, verse 54, he did eat. He just postponed it a little while. He didn't ignore the need that his body had. He wasn't foolish. There was just a period of time in which he delayed it. But he did take care of his bodily needs, and he slept. So this selflessness does not demonstrate itself in a foolishness. Was it not Robert Murray McShane who said, "God gave me a horse to ride and a message to preach. And now, as he was dying, he said, 'I've killed the horse, and I can no longer preach the message.'" That's foolishness. McShane himself admitted it. And it isn't necessary. Finally, verse 56. Just basic commitment. Because it says that he let nothing keep him from accomplishing his task or completing his task. And he said to them, "Do not delay me. Since the Lord has prospered my way, send me away that I may go to my master," and so on. The servant leader. The final passage that I want to mention is 1 Kings 12:7, and you are familiar with that. 1 Kings 12:7. The new king comes on the scene. The old men give him some instructions. The young men share their thoughts with him. He accepts the advice of the young men, and he got into difficulty. The advice of the old men was, basically, serve them, in verse 7. Serve them, and they will be your servants forever. Serve them, and they will be your servants forever. That's for all of us. It's for you, it's for the men in our administrative leadership spots. It's for the men you're trying to develop. Serve them, and they will be your servants forever. The servant leader, the overseer as a servant leader. Well, thank you for letting me share those thoughts. Nothing there is particularly new. I'm aware of that. Comes from a perspective of my observation more than anything else. And it's not intended in any way to berate, but to encourage us to this kind of spiritual oversight. Now, if you have any questions or thoughts that you would like to share, additions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Yes, Bruce, please.
On your fourth point on self-control, we didn't speak.
Right.
It seems like that would also include that he would be manipulative.
Good.
That he held what he said because he could have spoken out and manipulated the situation, but he didn't. I know that's a real tendency with me, especially with people I work with, to say the right things to get the right responses when it's not natural.
That's fantastic, because that concept of manipulating is one that that can happen so easily. Remember how they used to salt a gold mine? Some of you guys heard that phrase. When they were trying to sell a gold mine, they'd go in, they'd salt it. They'd take a shotgun and they'd load several cartridges with little pieces of gold, and they'd blast it into different places in the cave. And then when people would come in and they'd say, man, you can find some there, they'd start looking around, they'd find this and they'd buy the thing. And that was all there was to it. Well, we can do that. See, we can salt in the same way with certain comments. We can manipulate, or to use a more common word, we can politic to work things out to get what we want to see happen. That's right. Thank you for mentioning that. Gordy?
George, there's something I'd like to get out on the table.
All right.
And maybe go for the heart of this thing as far as I am concerned personally. And in some respects, this whole thing is directed toward me.
Well, I'm glad you arrived today yesterday. Because
yeah, I'm glad I'm here too.
I'm teasing.
I'm trying to evaluate the drift of Jack's messages yesterday and the drift of yours today. And the thing that I hear at the heart of it is that we are not available in an open way to the navigators in some degree or another. And that maybe part of the problem is that there aren't people available to fill some of the leadership vacuum that we have. Because some of us are running a little scared, don't have confidence in the leadership, and that kind of thing. Now, I want to express my honest feeling.
Good.
My feeling is to exhort me to do that won't work. What will do it is for me to see some changes that will mend my confidence. And where I am is that I see people and have observed what has happened to people within the navigators over the last 2 or 3 years, not reflecting on anyone's particular leadership. And I see what has happened to them and their families because they have done what you have suggested and Jack has suggested last night, total availability to the organization. And I am frankly not willing to pay that price because to me, it looks like on the part of that person, it was just sheer stupidity to allow themselves to be submitted to that kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. And then I listen to the exhortation to guard ourselves so that we are not burned out, so that we can be available for the organization to move. But yet I see the organization putting tasks on people that are killing type tasks. And I can mention a half a dozen names where I've watched that happen with two. And the organization has expected tremendous things from those people, without particularly taking into account the magnitude of the responsibility, and the guy being conscientious burns himself out. Why? Well, I say it's a dual responsibility. It's the man and it's the organization. Mm-hmm. Because I don't see that in some of these situations the organization has entered in and helped this person. It's kind of like expecting blood out of a rock. So when I watch this stuff, and I'm personally involved with people who over the last few years had this happen to them, I say to myself, self, I'm going to take the responsibility a little more under my control rather than turn this thing over as it was in the early years to the organization and say, well, whatever you want, I'll do. That is not my attitude. I will not do that because at this point, I have, I will reserve, you know, an inner action on whatever I'm asked to do because I have don't have the confidence that all things are being taken under consideration. As far as I'm concerned, personally, the organization can ask me to do whatever they want to, and I'd be happy for them to do that. And then consider it as best I can before God and work it out with them to do whatever it is they want me to do. But George, I'm afraid of it.
Man, I appreciate your honesty, Gordy. Could I respond to that, Bob? Is that okay?
I take a chance.
No, you're not, man. Look, you feel that way, and I don't blame you. But this is the kind of thing that I think needs to be expressed. I just wish that Jack was here and somebody else was here. Let me see if I can express what I think. First of all, let me put to rest that was the thrust of my message. That was not the thrust of my message. The thrust of my message was the oversight, the shepherding, the caring, the tending. And what I want to say is that responsibility goes right up to Lorne. What you're saying is you have not felt tended, cared for, in the sense that I was trying to project it.
I don't see people in leadership positions being tended, cared for, so that they don't plow into the side.
Precisely. Okay. So what I was saying and what I tried to communicate is that these are principles of leadership in its totality, not just for you guys here, but for Jack and for Lorne and for anybody else, for the divisional leaders who have that responsibility. When I said at the beginning that I find myself caught between the needs of the staff and the decisions that are made, this is what I mean. Now, the point that you made, if you understood me to say that this is a total capitulation of personal responsibility before God, that is not what I'm communicating. I am saying that if I make a decision, and you remember I mentioned at the beginning that I feel that the two of the tensions that exist today are the breakdown in communication, the personal communication up and down, and the confidence factor. I said that right at the beginning, and you've just reiterated that. And what I'm saying is, when that confidence factor is what it should be, then this kind of response is what there should be. This is what there was in the servant of Abraham. Because of his confidence, as I said, in God and in Abraham as God's man. You're expressing, and I appreciate your honesty, that confidence is not there. And it only verifies that I feel what I've said, that this is probably one of the things that we're facing. Confidence gap. Pardon? Of course you do, or you wouldn't be willing to stick your neck out this way.
Right, but it's kind of at an impasse right now in my mind. I don't know what's going to happen, or, you know, I don't see change.
Well, I think what needs to be done, for one thing, is that needs to be expressed when Lorne is here tomorrow. Hey, now look, if we're not going to do it, then the whole communication thing is going to fall apart. That's what's been happening too long. So somewhere, somebody has got to take the risk of expressing that. I can come back and I can say, here's what I'm picking up. But it doesn't ring as true as if in a group like this, there can be some honest expression of that kind. Chuck, let's get Bob over here and then we'll come to you, okay?
Yeah, I just... where I said we really want to express to Gordy appreciation for getting
you us bet. On the
floor.
You bet.
I think we all feel that. I don't think he's not easily. messages. And this is the group where this has got to come out. I'm greatly encouraged in that I think we're making progress. How do you restore the confidence that's being broken and being lacking? Well, to have honest communication. Well, boy, this group is becoming awfully honest. And as I travel around with the things that I get involved in, there's tremendous honesty. In fact, it's brutal. And 5 years ago, we never had that. There was no open forum. There was not the ability. Now, we got a long way to go. But I'm greatly encouraged. We've got to worry for anybody else. We've got to say, hey, my confidence can be shattered.
Right.
And I'm not so ready to jump into that arena.
Yep.
But that's why we're here. And I would encourage the same thing to come with Jack and the forum.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, thank you.
Chuck?
George, I have a little question. When you were talking about the servant
responding
immediately to Abraham,
mm-hmm.
Now, I always taken that Abraham would be styled there as Christ and the servant to Christ rather than to an individual, inasmuch as I'm not really the servant of the navigator, I've never felt myself that as much as a servant of Christ. And therefore, I immediately respond to Jesus Christ. If he commands, I respond. But if a man commands, I feel the obligation to go to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But you indicated, I thought, that that was not the case, that I ought to respond immediately to the organization of the man.
I think I appreciate that, because maybe I need some clarification there. I think what I try to communicate is that at some point in my life, I have made a decision, a commitment. And the commitment is to a fellowship, a body, the navigators. And I have made a commitment to the leadership of that organization because God has placed them in positions of leadership in that organization. There will be times when they will ask that I do something that I may not particularly want to do. In other words, it may not be the thing that I respond to as an individual. There may be something else I would rather do. But if I am still convinced that God has brought me into this organization to make the contribution that I can, and if I am still convinced, and this goes back to what Gordy is saying, that these men are there by God's appointment and I can trust God in that, and evaluating my responsibilities, which include my family, I did not say that we should carelessly treat these other areas of responsibility. But all things being equal at that point, I consider that then as the directive that I should respond to from God. Now, that has all kinds of variations in it, Chuck. I'm aware of that. I don't want to make an adamant point that our commitment is measured by our availability to an organization or to a man. I think I want to be very careful not to make that kind of an impression. So if I overpushed a point here, if somehow it communicated something that I did not mean to communicate, I appreciate your bringing that out, because I don't want to communicate that. Our allegiance, our ultimate commitment, has to be to what we believe God wants us to do, and there can be all kinds of factors involved in that. And the time may come when the navigators ask me to do something and I do not feel I can do it, and they say, well, if you can't do that, really there's not much else we want you to do in the organization, then I have to leave the organization. And I can see that happening. I don't have any problem with that, because God is the one that I'm serving anyway, and whether it's here or somewhere else, I can continue serving Him. So I don't want to communicate that, Chuck. Thanks for asking. Okay, I didn't see your hand. Go ahead.
On the same point, it seems that there's not much dialogue evident here.
Yeah.
But it would seem to me that we get into a lot of trouble when we don't exercise dialogue, because the thing that I feel more and more within the navigators is that my leaders don't know my situation. They don't know all of the facets and the facts of my family situation and so forth. And I feel just a tremendous responsibility when they suggest something or propose something that I inform them completely. And I think that is where we really get into trouble. We fear, or for some reason we do not inform them and we erect a barrier immediately. Well, they want me to do this, but I don't see how I can do that immediately. We're going into a conflict situation when we ought to be in a dialogue situation.
And that's where the knowing the face of our flock comes in. Your supervisors should know your situation to the point where they can effectively tend, shepherd, whatever, in your life. Yes?
I appreciate the tone of admitting our needs and dealing with them. However, for the sake of balance, I'd say that I haven't experienced that in our situation. I would say it's throughout the whole organization. And I say it for the sake of balance, not... I appreciate what the member's saying on the other side. I appreciate what you guys are saying. I think we ought to meet our needs, but I haven't observed or experienced what you're saying in my situation. I haven't been dealt with without due course of consideration.
Okay. Right. So it's just a matter of trying to add balance to it, that you have not felt that the organization has dealt with you without considering your...
At least the guys I work for have it.
Right. Okay.
I agree with Roy, and I think I have a responsibility to let everything be known about my situation. And I'm going to do that, until I'm sure that it's been communicated. I think what I want to feel from above is that it is being understood and it is being considered. And if I've got that feeling, then I feel okay in there. Then I can do what you say
right
at that point. But if I don't feel that, that's where I think I would get a little bit edgy. Then I have to start assuming responsibility for myself. But I cannot put trust in leadership that they're going to consider those things.
Yeah.
Let's get into what something he says. Something that he said is very important. He says it isn't a matter of whether the leadership does understand or not. It's that he feels they do.
Right.
And see, we all live in that situation. And our facts and our feelings are frequently very, very different. And so that's disappointing.
Good. Gordy, did you want to have other input? Your hand was up. Okay, Bob?
I'd like to say that being involved in the planning and knowing somewhat of Jack's thinking, I wouldn't detect anything of the type of thing that Gordy was talking about. The purpose of the conference is to get people to be willing to respond to the organization. I think rather that some of the problems, some of the fogging in the mountains that you talked about, have been due to the fact that the people that had the responsibilities hadn't had the training in how to handle leadership responsibilities and how to deal with these things and keep everything in perspective and do all these jobs rightly. And I think Jack's concern is that we begin to work on developing these areas that are going to be needed more and more as the ministry grows to the same extent that we've developed grassroots level.
Go ahead, Gordy.
Okay, now I have a response to that.
Good.
The people I'm referring to, by way of no one's treated me poorly from the Navigators. And personally, I'm very happy with the Navigators. I have no access to grinding. But I am very comfortable at the level where I am and scared to move because of the hazards of what lies ahead. And I have not observed those people well taken care of. And have watched some people given jobs who I don't think should have had jobs and proved out probably shouldn't have. And then this conference is designed to train me in leadership. But when I hear confusion from that podium, it does not instill confidence in me that the person who is training me in leadership knows much about leadership. So my confidence is not... instilled. You see what I mean? Like that little discussion we got into yesterday about authority, about responsibility. Man, that rocked me. It really did. I'm here to be trained in leadership, and the person who's training me needs to know about that stuff. Because I go other places and get it. get it straight. And that, now I'm laying it all out there.
Fine.
You know, it's interesting because my response to that exercise yesterday was, well, it was a philosophical exercise in semantics, the way I responded to the whole thing. So I think it's partly of its personality and not it.
Oh, man, there are definitions of those things. Those things are precise type things that can be discussed very intelligently, very helpfully. You know, when I hear your dad make the comment that you exercise leadership at various levels within the organization, and you need to do different things at different levels, and then you know, immediately I pop up and say, what are those things? Teach me. What do you do different running an area in the state and the region and that kind of stuff? And, you know, so far, we're into this leadership conference, and, you know, I'm still saying, teach me.
We've only been here 3 days.
You're just the way it is.
Thank you. Thank you for being willing to be honest. Alan?
I think one of the things that comes to my mind, speak up, I think one of the things that comes to my mind is that as you travel around, as you meet with staff, one staff person says, I have been abused. Then another staff person said, another. Well, then you look at the situation and you look at the leadership and you know the leadership and you say, that leader did not intend to do that. I know that leader. I know how he operates. And he didn't intend to do that. And the question that comes to your mind is you can't lay blame because you know the heart of the man. And then you ask a deeper question that is, well, is there something generically wrong with the way we're approaching it? The conclusion that I've come to is that we are overextended. And if I have a suspicion that if we went around this room and we sat down and we talked with each leader and we asked him how he feels about his situation, I would say that most leaders would say, I'm overextended. Now that can only mean that his family is suffering, his relationships are suffering, any number of things are suffering because he is overextended. And one of the things that was on my heart in coming into this conference is there something that we can do as an organization to come to grips with the fact that we are so overextended that we cannot do what we really and truly want to do in our hearts. And it just keeps us in a constant state of tension. Because I don't believe the problem is motive. I don't believe the problem is motive from a leadership level. I believe that every man I have ever worked with has a tremendous heart for God and wants to serve. And I think if you ask every man in this room what he wants to be a servant leader. I don't think there's any question about his availability. I think the question is, can he do the job that he's been given to do?
Can he do the job that he's been given to do? By that you mean, is it too extensive?
Well, we have...
Not his ability.
Yeah, right. We have one, as mentioned by Bob, is training. We need to be equipped to do the job that we're doing. But the other thing is a maintenance of a structure that we have. And the tendency is to look at it and say, well, we've got to keep going. We've got to keep going. We can't let that go. And I wonder if we don't, as an organization, need to sit...